Hello, I'm Mike Brown. This is number 0138, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0138. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer with his 21st novel, Triggers.
It's a fast-paced action-adventure thriller. A lot of people are comparing it, in fact, to, you know, thrillers as opposed to science fiction novels. And I'm very, very pleased with the reception. But it was really a nice palate cleanser to do something totally different from the WWW trilogy, while still being true to the things that I think make a hardcore Robert J. Sawyer book. A lot of philosophy, a lot of, you know, speculation about science and technology, and maybe a little bit of political commentary as well.
Science writer Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, is back to talk about the possibility that the Earth might have more than one moon.
You can have many moons, many objects orbiting a planet. But this study is very interesting because, you know, we've always thought that our moon is just by itself in orbit around the Earth. We see it alone, that silvery orb in the sky. But this new study says that it's not alone. In fact, there may be thousands of what they call mini moons.
And a look back at an interview with the late actor Jerry Orbach from Law and Order. During his career, he was constantly reinventing himself.
At some point, I was the song and dance guy who they said, oh, well, he doesn't do straight acting. Then I was the dramatic heavy actor. They said, well, he's not funny. And then I was saying to another guy the other day, Bochco was doing a thing called Cop Rock, where the cops sang, and somebody suggested me for it. And they said, oh, we love his work. Does he sing? So you get from one pigeonhole to another. And you do. You have to keep reinventing yourself.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0138 was Mike Brown, an audio producer in Alberta who recently launched his own production company called Radio King Productions. Be sure to like his page on Facebook and also send any audio job requests you have his way. And you could also follow him on Twitter. And thank you very much, Mike, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, you know the American economy is still bad when even the hookers have to work from a dollar menu. During a vice operation, a Bradenton, Florida detective inquired about sexual services from a suspected prostitute, later identified as Christine Baker. Baker allegedly replied that the pair could go have sex if the officer first bought her a double cheeseburger off the dollar menu at McDonald's. In addition to the cheeseburgers, Baker reportedly told the undercover officer that he could also give her a tip. In response, the cop handed over $60, of which he kept 40, took the McDonald's grub, and directed the cop to a vacant parking lot to, quote, park in and complete the deal, unquote. At this point, Ms. Baker was arrested by a takedown team and booked on a misdemeanor prostitution charge. Okay, here's the part of the story I don't understand. He gave her $60, and she only kept 40? Wow. Anyway, a 59-year-old man by the name of Raymond Charles Foley was caught on surveillance video, being quite gross, actually. He allegedly was urinating on four female co-workers' chairs at Farm Bureau Financial Services over the course of at least 5 months. Now, the company set up security cameras after several women complained of suspicious stains on their chairs in October. He was caught just recently on a Saturday at about 11:30 a.m., allegedly peeing on all four chairs. Foley is also suspected of going through the company's database of worker profiles to find his victims. An officer who wrote up a police report stated he would pick out the attractive females and then on off hours he would come into work, go to their desk, and urinate on their chairs. Foley's boss said the suspect admitted he was, quote, doing inappropriate things I shouldn't be doing. That's what he said just before he got fired, by the way. Foley turned himself into police on Monday and was charged with second-degree criminal mischief. Now, I'm trying to figure out a motive here. Maybe some sort of sick, twisted mating ritual. Maybe he's been watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom way too much as a child. I don't know. Anyway, in South Bend, Indiana, Ashley Murray said she had mixed feelings about pressing charges after 46-year-old Keith Davis was caught red-handed in her home. Apparently, while he was there, Davis folded Murray's clothes and vacuumed the entire house. Police later said that some drug had made Davis believe he was in his own home. Yes, if someone's going to break into your home, let it be to tidy up. That's what I always say. And it appears that for Easter 2012, Jesus has chosen a dead stingray as his medium to reveal himself to the faithful. 24-year-old Erica Scheld photographed a dead stingray that had washed up on the beach at James Island, South Carolina. She then noticed an image on the ray's back that was somewhat familiar. She said, "I just kind of thought it looked like a bearded homeless guy, but when I posted pictures on Instagram, one of my friends was like, 'That's Jesus!' And I was like, 'Oh my God, you're right!'" Scheld, who, by the way, is a Catholic, said, "I did think it was interesting with Easter coming up, and it's such a beautiful image on such a harmful thing." In the last year, images of the Almighty have been seen on Walmart receipts, the side of a cliff, and even a fish stick. Yes, the Lord works and shows up in mysterious ways. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the program, imagine being so stoned that you crash your car into a Krispy Kreme, then get into another car crash and are charged with DUI all on the same day. Oh yeah, and imagine that you're also a pastor. That's what allegedly happened to 47-year-old Jay Bertrand, who is pastor at the Verena Baptist Church in Virginia. Police say just hours after Jay was released from the hospital following the Krispy Kreme crash, he got into another accident, this time with his wife's car, when he allegedly failed to move when a traffic light turned green, causing a woman in a vehicle behind him to drive around him. When she stopped at the intersection, Bertrand ran into the back of her vehicle. Bertrand's family says it's all due to pain medication that he had been taking for back problems. A senior pastor at Verena Baptist Church, Jerry Liebert, added, "This is not because of any drug abuse or because of any kind of alcohol abuse. He's a good guy. He's not a troublemaker. He's not a lawbreaker. It's totally circumstantial, and he hates it as bad as we do." Well then, yes, let's just, I don't know, I'll let him go, shall we? Once again, the Lord works in mysterious ways. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. One of the most prolific science fiction writers is Robert J. Sawyer. He has just released his 21st novel. It's called Triggers. And Robert is traveling around right now on his book tour, but he's taken a little time to talk to us about his latest tome. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just hanging in there. Thanks for being on the program with us. It's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you. So you have this new book out called Triggers, and I know there's a lot of Robert J. Sawyer fans who enjoy reading the work that you do and love when something new comes out. What's it like for you as a writer, when, especially considering you just finished working on your trilogy? When you come up with something that is completely new, are you like a kid in a candy store when you're writing it?
Well, I am exactly. The trilogy you refer to, the WWW trilogy of Wake, Watch, and Wonder about the World Wide Web gaining consciousness, I took 6 years of my life. And although I loved the characters that I created for it and I loved the reception that the trilogy got, it was very much time for me to move on to something fresh. As Monty Python would say, and now for something completely different. And Triggers is that project. It's a fast-paced action-adventure thriller. A lot of people are comparing it, in fact, to, you know, thrillers as opposed to science fiction novels. And I'm very, very pleased with the reception. But it was really a nice palate cleanser to do something totally different from the WWW trilogy, while still being true to the things that I think make a hardcore Robert J. Sawyer book. A lot of philosophy, a lot of speculation about science and technology and maybe a little bit of political commentary as well.
Well, tell us what Triggers is about.
Triggers starts with an attempted assassination of the U.S. president when he's giving a speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to calm the nation after a home soil terrorist attack in Chicago. He's rushed to the hospital in Washington, D.C., where surgeons try to save him. Upstairs in the same hospital, it happens, there's a Canadian memory researcher who's working with an Iraq War vet to try and erase the vet's traumatic memories of the Iraq conflict that have been causing him post-traumatic stress disorder. A bomb goes off in Washington. The electromagnetic pulse scrambles the researcher's equipment, and the effect is that the memory machine ends up linking a couple of dozen people in this hospital building, one to the next in the chain, where they can read memories in turn. The president is reading the soldier from Iraq. Somebody is reading the president. Nobody knows who it is. It's on the eve of a major American military operation, and all of national security is at stake, trying to identify who is now accessing everything the commander-in-chief knows.
Wow. Looking back at your career, as I mentioned, this is your 21st novel. When you look back at what you've written from 1 through 20, do you see a progression? Do you see, because earlier you alluded to a Robert J. Sawyer book. So how has that changed over the 21 books?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Peter. When I started out, I was doing very traditional science fiction, spaceships, aliens, off Earth. You know, my heroes were writers of the stripe of Larry Niven, Hal Clement, people who were known for that kind of work. And I realized that I absolutely was being well-received by the science fiction audience, but I wasn't getting people who weren't already self-identifying as science fiction readers. And I thought, you know, maybe I had something to say to the world at large. So I dialed it back. I brought it all to the present day or the near future. Triggers is set next year, right after the presidential election. And I brought it mostly dispensed with aliens and all of those trappings that people associate with science fiction, but really dealt with the philosophical thought experiment kinds of things that science fiction really has at its heart and soul. The thought experiment in Triggers is, you know, what would it really be like to access somebody else's memories? I don't think it's ever been well handled in fiction. Everybody has this kind of conceit that they have a digital video recorder or a hard drive somewhere in their skulls that is recording with absolute fidelity everything they see and hear. So that if I read your mind, Peter, I would see your living room exactly as you see your living room. But that's not how it works at all. I've never been to your living room. You might remember that you have a couch, but not really recall the pattern on it. I couldn't recall the pattern if you didn't recall it, if I was reading your mind, but I would fill in a pattern. You might have a vague sense that you have a plaid couch, and I would fill in some plaid that I had seen, not the real plaid. And the way we reconstruct memories ourselves is so much, the word is confabulation, making it up as we go along. But it seems reasonable to us, and so we take it as true. And when somebody else is confabulating your memory, the little cues you hold, the reconstruction they come up with may be wildly different from what really went down. And I think, you know, that was a central philosophical question, but it's very different than the spaceships and aliens kinds of science fiction that I started out with 2 decades ago now.
I know that you do a lot of research when you put together a story such as this and put a lot of, obviously, a lot of thought into it. In the whole idea of reading someone else's mind, have you discussed this with family, with friends, with your wife, and talked about the possibilities of how this would work?
Well, I have, and I've also talked to memory researchers, too. I mean, you know, we think that you did a litany of people there, family, friends, family, my wife, Carolyn, and we think, these people know us better than anybody else on the planet, and yet they know the tiniest, tiniest fraction of what's actually going on in our heads, the stream of consciousness, all the things that we think and keep to ourselves. In fact, I was at a scriptwriting seminar 2 weekends ago, the Toronto Scriptwriting Conference, that a guy who writes sitcoms, and he said, you know what the difference is between real characters and sitcom characters? Sitcom characters have no inner censor. They say whatever is on their mind, and that's where the humor comes from. Because we all know instinctively that 99% of everything we think, oh, when your wife asks if this dress make me look fat, you know what answer you're supposed to say, but you've got the whole litany of other answers that are going through your head. And the rest of our, even our closest confederates and lovers don't know us. And if they were able to know us, would they still love us? Would they still like us? It's actually a very daunting question. And the theme of the novel very much came out of the whole question of transparency. We ask for transparency in government. We ask for transparency in business. We've become very transparent in the way that we expose ourselves online, Facebook and so forth. But the notion of real interpersonal transparency is something that we haven't yet faced, and I wanted to explore that in Triggers.
Is transparency something, even though we ask for it, is it something that we really want?
Well, that's exactly right. I think the bottom line is that we want it for everybody but us. You know, I want to know everything that my business associates and my friends and my coworkers are thinking, but I don't want them to know what I'm thinking. So there's no desire for reciprocity. And what the novel does is gives us that reciprocity. And absolutely, the first things that knee-jerk occurred to me, and I imagine well to my readers, are the negatives of it. You know, the guy who is cheating on his spouse, or the employee who is pilfering from work or whatever, suddenly that's laid bare. The flip side is I found a lot of positives to it, and relationships that actually became more intertwined and more intimate than ever before possibly imagined. And that was part of the joy of constructing the novel Triggers.
I've mentioned when talking to you in the past that you are also very, very good at promotion. You have a great website. You're on most of the social networks. And now you're crisscrossing the globe practically with this book tour. What's harder work for you, if I can quantify it, the writing of the book or the promoting of the book?
The promoting of the book is actual work, in that at the end of the day, I'm exhausted. When I'm writing the book, it's hard work, but you don't break a sweat sitting at the keyboard, Peter. You know, it's a very enjoyable, pleasant day. My ideal day, not that I get too many of them, is I have a lovely penthouse in Toronto. I look up at my great views. I've got a fire going in the fireplace. Feet up, I'm sitting in a recliner chair with a cordless keyboard in my lap, and I'm writing away. It's heaven. When I'm out here, you know, you caught me actually in Calgary today, and I'm running around doing all kinds of stuff. There's media, there's all this and that. And at the end of the day, you've had a blast, and everybody says, oh, wow, what a great life. You're traveling everywhere, but you're really exhausted. You've hardly seen, you don't get to see the sights. You see, you know, the inside of the green room at the local noon television show, and, you know, you run to radio stations, and then you see a lot of bookstores and a lot of airports. So that part is work. But that said, I count my blessings. There's so many authors these days who are getting no support from their publishers or are self-publishing. And I'm lucky that Penguin, my publisher, is behind me 100%, puts real money into promoting my books. And I have to do everything I can in terms of writing the best I can to justify the expense they put in trying to bring the books to the public's attention.
The book is called Triggers, and now that you're traveling around doing this book tour, does everything you see and do as a writer, as a creative person, trigger more ideas?
Oh, it does. You know, I'm fond of telling the story. My wife and I will be out at dinner, and, you know, there'll be a couple at the next table or two tables over who are having a fight about money or their kids. And my wife will be mortified, as will other people in the restaurant. And I'm kind of leaning over and, like, taking notes. This is good. This is gold. Oh, my God. Did you hear what he said? Because it, everything from little character stuff like that to big ideas. When I do go on book tour, if I have a chance, if there's one thing I can visit in a town, I always make sure to go visit a cutting-edge science facility. I went to visit, you know, the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, the synchrotron in Saskatoon I first visited on a book tour, for instance, and the Kennedy Space Center and that sort of thing, because there always is great fodder for the kind of stuff that I write. And when I was writing Triggers, which, you know, takes place in Washington, D.C., I went down to Washington and got the behind-the-scenes tour, George Washington University Hospital, where they'd saved Ronald Reagan from an assassination attempt. Always, when I do have an opportunity, everything is fodder. Everything is grist for the mill.
Excellent. Well, Robert, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us once again, and continued success with your writing and this latest book, Triggers.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Robert J. Sawyer, author of Triggers. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0138, and you'll find links to Robert's website, plus links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, about the possibility of the Earth having more than one moon. And we'll check the old archives, have a retro interview, look back at one of the stars who is no longer with us anymore, Jerry Orbach from the television series Law & Order. Had a chance to meet with him several years ago when he was here in Montreal. We'll play a portion of that program for you, or at least that interview, a little later on. But right now, let's get to the Stuff File news, part deux. We often share stories of people who get into trouble for misusing 911. Well, here's the latest. A Florida man is serving 60 days in jail for misuse of 911. When he called the emergency line because his wife would not leave him alone to let him check his Facebook. The Pasco County Sheriff's Office said Doyle Hardwick called 911 and told the dispatcher his wife refused to stop sitting next to him and go to bed. Hardwick, who was 57, told the operator his wife told him she would go to bed if he let her drink some beers, but she refused to leave the seat next to him upon finishing her beverages. He said he was upset his wife would not let him, quote, look at Facebook peacefully, unquote. That's what was in the 911 transcripts. Deputies said both Hardwick and his wife smelled of alcohol when they arrived at the home. Hardwick pleaded no contest to misusing the 911 system back in February, and an arrest warrant was issued when he failed to show up to serve his sentence. He has since turned himself in and began serving his 60 days. Gee, I wonder what his status line says now that he's in jail. Meanwhile, British Columbia story from Abbotsford. Three young, drunken, and naked BC men escaped charges and came out squeaky clean after riding a grocery cart through a car wash. Police in Abbotsford were called after midnight by neighbors who heard screaming coming from a drive-through 24-hour car wash. Constable Ian McDonald said when officers arrived, they found three 23-year-old inebriated men getting dressed. The trio told officers they had stripped and gotten into a shopping cart to ride through the car wash. Not knowing at this point whether they picked Typhoon or Super Typhoon, I'd suggest that either of those and the combination of the brushes that would have come past them would be enough to definitely leave you with a little bit of a memory of what you had done the prior night, said McDonald. Police issued warnings, but didn't charge the men. McDonald told the CBC it was fortunate the trio hadn't selected a hot wax cycle. Well, give them points for hygiene, I always say. And in Evansville, Indiana, a man is arrested for allegedly breaking into a dog pen. Evansville police said Noble Gray II was found half-naked inside a dog pen at a home on First Street. Police told the dog's owner, former Vandenberg County Commissioner Cheryl Musgrave, that Gray was trying to get her dog to lick his backside. Ew. Police say Gray had been drinking and is facing trespassing and public intoxication charges. Okay, so if for some reason you don't like using toilet paper, perhaps I suggest getting a bidet. How about that? A resident of South Strabane Township, Pennsylvania, heard a noise in an upstairs bedroom after he got up, so he went to investigate. He found a burglar in the bedroom who, upon being discovered, pulled a knife. The unnamed homeowner was holding a cup of coffee and smashed the burglar in the face with the cup. He really split him open, said Township Police Detective John Bruner. There was a lot of blood. The burglar fled and was driven away by an accomplice. Police are looking for a 30-ish-year-old man with a gash to his forehead. And what have we learned from this incident, boys and girls? Well, never interrupt a man having his first cup of coffee. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police responded to a domestic dispute at a restaurant in Vero Beach, Florida. The alleged victim told officers he had called his girlfriend, Courtney Godwin, for a ride to work, but worried she would be late, he got a ride from a friend. Now, according to his statement, Godwin, who was 24, then showed up at his work and began yelling at him for not waiting for her. She then beat him and threw a jack, a chair, and rocks at him, then jumped in a car and tried to run him over. But he didn't want to make a formal statement right away. His primary concern was getting back home because she told him that she was going to set fire to his clothes. It made me mad, Godwin told police, because I do everything for him, and now he wants to try and make me look bad by having someone else drive him to work when I always take care of him. Wow. Running your guy over isn't taking care of him, at least in this context. She has some strange views on what loving care is. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Looking up into the sky at night, you see the moon. Well, that lunar surface might not be alone. The Earth might just have other moons. And joining us via Skype-to-Skype communications is Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, who is here once again to set us straight about astronomy. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
So what's this deal with the moon? And I guess maybe we should start out by classifying exactly what a moon is, because things keep changing, like we lose planets like Pluto, and now we gain moons. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you know, it's in case of what a moon is classified as, it's pretty much the same as it's been for time immemorial. It's really an amazing thing, this particular study, in fact, because, you know, when we look up at the moon, and how we classify a moon, of course, is that a moon is an object that revolves around the planet, like the Earth. Earth, what we've thought of up to now, has one moon that orbits our planet. You know, compare that to Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system, that has the record of 64 moons orbiting it. So you can have many moons, many objects orbiting a planet. But this study is very interesting because, you know, we've always thought that our moon is just by itself in orbit around the Earth. We see it alone, that silvery orb in the sky. But this new study says that it's not alone. In fact, there may be thousands of what they call mini-moons that orbit around the Earth.
Okay, so wait a minute here. We've evolved to the point, scientifically speaking, that we can see further and further out into space. We've seen the other planets that are in our solar system, the moons that surround them. Since we can see so far, how have we not seen these alleged moons before? They're closer to us.
Right, but you have to remember now, these, you know, unlike the moon that we see in the sky, which is near 2,000 miles across, these guys that we're talking about are mostly the size of a washing machine. And they are, some of them are even farther out away from Earth than the moon orbits. I mean, the farthest the moon can get is about 400,000 kilometers. And then you have something the size of a washing machine that may be twice as far away, but still orbiting the Earth. That is really a tricky thing to be able to see, even with the largest telescopes that we have.
Okay, so something that small, washing machine size, as you say, what makes that a moon as opposed to being what we think of as an asteroid? Or is that completely different?
Well, no. In fact, these are considered asteroids. You know, an asteroid can be anything the size of a, you know, say a golf ball to the size of the state of Texas. I mean, they can be really big or really small. But what makes an asteroid a moon is that it actually ends up orbiting our planet. And this is what's so interesting, is that there is a constant change of a change out of these mini moons, of these mostly washing machine sized rocks that come and get captured by Earth's gravity and hang around the Earth in very very complex kind of twisty orbits, and then get kicked out back into the solar system again to orbit the sun. So their stay around the Earth is probably measured in the order of months, maybe up to a year or so, that they actually orbit the Earth. And then they return to their normal asteroid habits after a year once they get kicked out.
Are any of these things malleable? In other words, could they come together and form larger, I hate to say the word moons, but larger asteroids, let's say?
Not really. And that's because they don't really get a chance to come together, because they're just so, first of all, they're so far apart from each other. We're talking about distances on the order of hundreds of thousands of kilometers to millions of kilometers, and also the speeds that they're traveling. We're talking about 25 kilometers per second, the average speed of these little washing machine-sized rocks. And so what's actually interesting, Peter, is that these astronomers that have come up with this computer model to calculate this, they say that some of them actually burn up in our atmosphere. So, you know, it's just, think of that. Some of these asteroids that pass by Earth are moving slow enough and in the right direction to be actually captured by Earth and its gravity. So, you know, you look up into the sky, it's kind of neat to think that, you know, some of those that light up our night sky are one of these little mini moons that may have orbited Earth for up to a year.
Okay, so these things are orbiting the Earth. They can be as small, as you say, as a washing machine, and as large as the state of Texas, or even bigger, perhaps?
Yeah, some of them can be very large, but really the ones that that we think are actually being captured by Earth's gravity are really small. You know, these... what astronomers are saying, they estimate that there may be one or two of these washing machine-sized mini-moons, about 1 meter across, and they're actually maybe 1,000 larger than, a softball at any one time. So imagine 1,000 softball-sized mini-moons or asteroids orbiting Earth, some beyond the orbit of a moon, farther away than the moon, some much closer. And sometimes those, you know, softball or baseball-sized little rocks do end up being burnt up in the atmosphere, and we see them as a shooting star at night.
And like what we know as our moon, can any of these things, especially some of the larger ones, have any kind of an effect whatsoever, even if it's minuscule, on our tides like our full-size moon does?
Not really, because their mass are so small. Their gravitational effects are just that much smaller. I mean, we do know that moons can have an effect, as you mentioned, the tides, for instance. But you know, it also has to do with the distance. Like, for instance, in case of our moon, and to have a real effect, you have to have a sizable moon, like the one Earth has, to have an effect on our on a planet. So, for instance, a little known effect, for instance, is you may have heard of the supermoon effect. That we've actually, I think, talked about it on your show months ago, when the moon appears in the full moon in the sky appears unusually large, and that's because it every once in a while the moon gets a little closer to Earth than average, say about 50,000 kilometers closer than usual. And when that happens, the moon can actually the fact that it's closer to our planet can influence the tides more than usual. So, for instance, if there's an area that has a possibility of a hurricane coming on shore during high tide, when we have a supermoon, a moon that's closer to us, then we can have localized flooding. So that's much more dramatic than it would usually happen on any old full moon even. So yes, indeed, having a large object closer to Earth can influence gravities. But when you're talking about washing machine size and softball size stuff, those effects are just totally not noticeable at all.
So for the really anal retentive people at home who want to keep score, we still have basically only 8 planets and one moon for Earth.
Well, one major moon.
One major moon.
Something that we may have to add a little caveat there and say that there is one major moon and maybe 1,000 mini moons. How about that?
Wow.
Pretty interesting.
Which leads me to a slightly facetious question, because we talk about other planets and their moons, and all the other moons are named. Ours is simply called the Moon. Does it have a name, or should we give it one, since it might not be alone?
I don't know. It might be interesting, but can you imagine naming 1,000 of these?
No. Just naming the big one what we have.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Luna, a lunatic. But that's true. Maybe we should set up a lobby. What do you think, Peter? We should give it a name.
Well, somebody will probably do that corporately.
Yeah, somebody's going to try to earn a buck on that. Eh?
Just like they name stadiums. Andrew, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I should mention that this topic came up because it was the topic of one of your latest articles, which you paraphrased on your site, thenightskyguy.com. I'll get it out. And it's an article that you wrote for National Geographic News, correct?
That's right. Yes, I'm a correspondent for National Geographic News, and this was a feature story this week. It caught a lot of people's attention. Of course, everybody looks up at the moon, so it's kind of neat to think we have 1,000 mini moons up there. It's a cool story.
And it's stuff like this that's always a great read on your site. People should check it out, thenightskyguy.com. I thank you very much, Andrew, for being on the program with us once again.
My pleasure, and clear skies.
Andrew Vazekas, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In today's competitive job market, one of the things that almost every college student hopes to get before they graduate is an internship. Regardless of what they're studying, students know that one of the best ways to get the experience they need is to get an internship while they're still in school. Unfortunately, it's getting harder to obtain an internship these days because of lawsuits. Even though interns gain valuable experience and contacts that can help them after they graduate, some of them want even more. They want money, too. Targets of recent lawsuits by unpaid interns include Harper's Magazine and talk show host Charlie Rose. College counselors now say that these and other lawsuits are prompting some employers to stop offering internships. Let's be fair, this isn't just shameful, it's hurtful to other students. Many of the best internships in America are unpaid, including those at the White House. It's an experience that helps people get jobs, and America's lawsuit problem is getting in the way. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is The Stuff File.
And we're going to do something new on the Stuff File program, which is actually something old. Over the last 25 years or so, I've had the pleasure to talk to some great stars of the past who, unfortunately, are no longer with us. I thought I would, over the next little while, feature a few of the past interviews I've been lucky enough to do. The first one up is a chat I had back in August of 1997. It was with actor Jerry Orbach, best known as Detective Lenny Briscoe, on the long-running NBC police drama Law & Order. Jerry was actually here in Montreal on vacation. He came to town to check out the Just for Laughs festival that summer. Just for Laughs, by the way, is another place that I work at. So it gave me a chance to catch up with him and go through his career just a little bit. I caught up with him at the bar of the Delta Hotel, which for years was sort of the nerve center for those participating in the festival. Here's part of that interview now.
The show was a great success in NBC. It's been on for quite a few years now, and the ironic thing about the show is, unlike a lot of shows that are on for a long time, it actually seems to be getting better with age.
It seems to be getting better and getting more popular. It's amazing. I don't know exactly what it is. I think the writing's been strong, and I think some of the cast changes have kept it fresh in a lot of ways. We certainly try very, very hard to keep the quality up, and God bless them. More and more people are watching.
Now, you've had a long, illustrious career. You've done a lot of things in television and in films and in on Broadway stage. And talking about television just for a moment, you shoot Law & Order in New York. Is that a different set of rules, a different pace than shooting in traditional Los Angeles areas where most of the studios are?
Yes. Several things about New York make it different. One is the pace. The pace is enormously fast. The other is the background of New York City itself. And also the talent pool of the actors that we draw on as our character people. If you look at something like NYPD Blue, which I love Dennis Franz and Jimmy Smits, they're terrific. But you see what they do is they walk down a New York street and then they turn and walk into a building. And once they're inside the building, they're in Los Angeles. Or they drive, you know, we call them drive-ups and walk-ins. So they'll shoot a week's worth of those and they've got their New York background for the season. But they don't have the New York actors that we get off the street almost, that the gritty look of some people. It's hard to say, but there's an ethnicity about it, too. You know, if we have a Puerto Rican drug dealer, and they have a Puerto Rican drug dealer, this is really a Mexican, you know, because it's L.A., you know, everything's a little different. But New York is the greatest backdrop in the world, you know.
Now, as an actor, when you're working on location, is it also a different situation? I mean, I would assume in L.A., everything shoots in L.A., and they're used to seeing crews on the road, and they're kind of blasé about it. But it's not as an everyday occurrence in New York, even though you guys have been there for quite a few years, and other shows like New York Undercover have been there for a few years.
Well, actually, New Yorkers are pretty used to filming on the streets, and they tend to be cooperative, although we've had people walk right between us on the sidewalk in the middle of a take, you know, that are completely unaware of what's going on. But in general, Benjamin Bratt, he calls me the king because, you know, it's not that I know everybody in New York, but I've been there a long time, and any neighborhood we go into, the restaurateurs and the shopkeepers and everybody, oh, Jerry, how you doing? And it's sort of the world is at your feet, you know. It's a very pleasant way to work.
Well, some of your greatest success came on Broadway.
Well, my big breakthrough was the original Fantastics. I originated El Gallo in the Fantastics, and I did Carnival, Promises, Chicago, 42nd Street, some major, major musicals. You know.
So in doing Broadway, and you know the city very well, it seems like you always have to reinvent yourself in that some people know, you know, Jerry Auerbach, the singer, the guy who does Broadway musicals, the guy who does Disney cartoons, and there are those who know Jerry the actor and don't know the other Jerry.
Maybe it's not good to be versatile. I don't know. Maybe I should just stay in one corner. But yeah, they pigeonhole you. They pigeonhole you in one place, and they say, oh, he's a song and dance man. He does musicals. Then I did a film called Prince of the City for Sidney Lumet, and I started doing cops and gangsters like FX and some other things like that. And they say, oh, he's a dramatic actor. He's not funny. Then I do some comedy or Lumiere or something like that, and they say, oh, he's this and he's that. And at some point, I was the song and dance guy who they said, oh, well, he doesn't do straight acting. Then I was the dramatic heavy actor. They say, well, he's not funny. And then I was saying to another guy the other day, Bochco was doing a thing called Cop Rock, where the cops sang, and somebody suggested me for it, and they said, oh, we love his work. Does he sing? So you get from one pigeonhole to another, and you do. You have to keep reinventing yourself.
In working in your career over, what, about 40 years, I guess, you've been doing this? If you were a casting agent and you said, I've got the perfect role for Jerry Auerbach, what would that role be, knowing what your career has been for the last four decades?
Well, if it was me, you know, I'd say Rhett Butler in The New Gone with the Wind. I don't know. I mean, you know, give me the best role you can think of. My thing has always been what we used to call just acting. They now call character acting. I just did a little movie with Al Pacino called Chinese Coffee, where I'm going to play I'll be doing something that nobody's ever seen me do, which I love. It's a raging intellectual whose extremely flowery language and bitter critic of writers and things that I've never done anything like, but that I'm capable of doing. That's the way I came up, the way I learned. I did Shakespeare, I did Chekhov and Ibsen and Shaw and everything. So that when I do one of these guys, you know, if I do the guy off the street, if I'm doing sort of a Danny Aiello or whatever, that don't mean that's all what I can do, you know? So that's fun for me, is to recreate myself and do different characters, be different people.
Yeah. Now that you're so associated with Lenny Briscoe, first of all, did you do a lot of research with police officers when you got the role? And now that you had the role for so long, the reaction from actual police officers?
I didn't do a lot of research when I got the role because I had done research for about 30 years. I've known a lot of detectives, a lot of cops. And, of course, the reaction from them is probably the best part, the greatest reward for this type of show, where the cops on the street say, hey, keep making us look good, you know, which is, to me, the highest form of flattery.
Not too long ago, there was some controversy. I guess it's still ongoing, the whole situation with the ratings for television shows, the way they'll be rated for viewing. And I know that your producer, Dick Wolf, is one of the ones most adamant, and your network is behind him too, most adamant in not caving into some of the rules and regulations that people would like to see enforced on televisions and how they're going to be rated. How do you feel about the whole controversy?
Well, I think all these letter ratings like violence and sex and strong language and, you know, in the feature films you have PG-17 and R and X, and those seem to work all right because you see the child walking in and buying a ticket. I came home one night many years ago when my older son was about 12 and he was watching the Blue Channel on cable. Well, I told him to turn it off. Parents have to determine that, because if there's 100 channels out there, unless you have some kind of blocker on the set, they're going to watch anything they want unless you tell them not to. I don't think that the rating system is going to make a hell of a lot of difference in what the kids watch or what they want to watch. I think it's really up to the parents. I mean, if you see somebody's naked behind on NYPD Blue, which I don't really agree with, but okay, they do it now and then. Does that mean that everybody should turn that show off? That it's appealing to prurient interests? That it's obscene? I don't think so. I mean, I don't agree that they need it, but I also think that language can't really hurt you. Language can't hurt you if it's true to the way people really talk. I hate it when abusive language is used without a reason. But when somebody's angry or somebody has to express themselves the way they really do on the street, fine, doesn't bother me at all. But I think you have to be a grown-up for that. And grown-ups have to watch what the kids watch. They have to tell them no.
Getting back to your show, Law & Order, again, it's successful for so long, and there is a realism to it, there's a grit to it, but the one thing that I often hear about the show, and I'm sure I've heard in interviews with the actors too, is that you don't get much texture from the characters that play the roles. It's more the work and the case involved. Does that make it a little difficult from an actor's point of view?
It does. I think it's not as rewarding for us in terms of Emmy nominations. We don't get to be very emotional. We I try to inject some humor into the proceedings, you know, and once in a while we get touched or moved by something when the scripts allow us to. But it is a little cut and dried. It's a little cut and dried. But that's the way police work is, you know. And as long as we're true to it, basically we're saying, you know, what color was the car? How many people were there? What time did he leave? You know, did you ever hear them argue before? All those kind of questions. That's what we have to do. Otherwise, the damn thing is going to get mired down in who'd you sleep with last night? And, you know, did you get drunk? And that's not what our show's about.
We know a little bit about Lenny. We know that he's a recovering alcoholic. We know that he's been married several times. But since we don't know a lot about Lenny, do you as an actor have to create in your mind what Lenny's background is to play him? Or is that not even important?
Oh, I create a background for him. Here's my wife now, who's in the background. Yeah, of course, Lenny has a background in my head, but only occasionally does it surface. Like when my daughter showed up last year, and she's going to show up again. There'll be some personal things sneaking their way in a little bit here and there.
With the constant changes of the cast in that show, and it's gone through quite a few over the years, let's look at it from two point of views. One, you came into the show not in the first year, but years later. Was it a warm welcome for you from the rest of the crew? And what's it like when someone new, now that you're a veteran on the show, comes on the program?
It's a very warm welcome. They don't stand by and wait to see if they're going to like you or not. They want to like you, and they want to have you as it's a team. First of all, it's part of a team, and nobody's really just out for themselves, because if you are, you'll get buried. You'll get buried if you are. You've got to be helping each other out. And I had the warmest kind of welcome right from the beginning. That's the way it's got to be on something like this, where you work 12-hour days, and sometimes they go to 15, you know, 16 on a Friday night sometimes. You better like each other.
It is one of the best shows on television. Do you feel you're getting the amount of promotion your show deserves from the network?
We never do. Of course not. You know, Homicide gets tremendous critical acclaim all the time. We're going to do a crossover with them, but Homicide's laying like number 75. We're up there in the 20s, which is great. We don't get the kind of promotion that the sitcoms get, certainly. And the sitcoms make a lot of money for them. It's must-see TV, except it stops at 10 o'clock. They never, you know, they say, it's Seinfeld and Matt, you know, and so-and-so, and then you have to look at the TV, go, oh, yeah, there's Law and Order, too. Comes on after all the fun's over. Yeah, we always feel we don't get enough promotion, but it's the same thing as being a show that's based in New York and saying, well, the L.A. shows get all the nominations for the Emmys, which is generally true, because people vote for the things that give them work, and most of the work is out there. But this year, maybe it'll be Law and Order's turn. The show's up for an Emmy, so...
I find it's ironic that you probably get some of your best promotion on another network, A&E.
That's right. Well, that's they don't compete with us. That's a nice cable network, and I think that people who at 3 in the morning or something, or 1 in the afternoon, flip on A&E, and they see an older episode of Law and Order, it may lead them to watch it on the network. And they say, oh, gee, I never watched this before. Let me check it out at Wednesday at 10. You know, so it helps us.
Do you get a chance to spread your wings a little bit and do other things besides Law and Order during your hiatus, for instance?
Well, mostly I've just wanted to lay down and rest, but this year I did this movie, Chinese Coffee, with Al Pacino, that Al directing, and it's basically a two-character piece, just the two of us, so it's pretty exciting.
I thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
That was an interview with actor Jerry Orbach, who played the role of Lenny Briscoe in the long-running NBC police drama Law and Order. I spoke to Jerry in August of 1997 when he came to town for the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival. Jerry Orbach passed away on December 28, 2004, from prostate cancer. He was 69.
The Stuff File.
And we still have one more item before we wrap things up on this edition of the Stuff File program, and that, of course, would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
New Mexico authorities have arrested three men found with a 220-pound calf in the backseat of their car. The Carlsbad Courant Argus reports that the men are accused of cattle rustling. They were jailed on charges of suspicion of larceny of livestock, conspiracy, lack of a bill of sale, and exporting livestock. Luna County Sheriff's Office says a deputy pulled over their Honda Civic and saw the animal sharing the backseat with one of the alleged thieves. The three are being held at the Luna County Detention Center. Cow, officer? What cow? Okay, this is a story that is utterly ridiculous. How can three guys in a Honda Civic think they can ride around with a stolen calf in the backseat and think they could get away with it? One reason and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0138. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. On the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0138. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.